Let's open to the scriptures first, and I'll come back to this in just a second, but open to Exodus chapter 3. You know, the testimony, what we're talking about are the lies that destroy lives, and we're going to counter those. And there's no better way than countering them than with the truth. And we talked about what that was 2 weeks ago, and how can you find truth? And truth is the culmination of everything that comes together. Truth is just not simple facts put it here and pulled there simply to prove a point, because you can pretty much prove anything you want if you want to find the right pieces of information. And a lot of times we can look at the distance of things and not know the specifics and come to a conclusion. And many times those conclusions can be dead wrong. A lot of times we can look at what's happening in the world and we can ask this question, where in the world is God? How can God be both merciful and powerful? Because if he was merciful, he would do something. If he was powerful, he could do it. If you're like the world, you've asked that question. As I've asked that question. As things come around, you can ask, where are you, God? How can you let this happen? But as the testimony of the young man appears, the testimony of each and every one of us, we can testify to this. Though the world may see things on the outside, they can observe the circumstances. We have an opportunity to tell them, you know, it was because God used this. He used this to bring me to himself. Would I have chosen this manner? No. Would I have chosen him? No. But God starts it and he finishes it. And at times the world may look at a distance and draw conclusions that are dead wrong. And what we're going to do is we're going to counter the lies that destroy lives. And those lies could live in your own life. As we proceed down the weeks and down in a few weeks, we'll talk about the lies in the church. We'll talk about the lies in society. Well, right now we're going to talk about the lies about God. Because, you know, it's kind of interesting. I remember in high school, kids, as we all do, you kind of get this persona, right? Well, sometimes that persona is not welcome. I didn't want that persona. I didn't want people to view me that way. And sometimes you're thinking, I like that persona. It's not the truth, but I can enjoy that. And there were times where I moved through high school and sports became my vehicle to popularity. And I was good at it. And so they made some assumptions about me that were nice, but they were not true. And other times they would look at my life and they say, that guy is crazy. He's got to be drunk. Kind of like the apostles when they were accused on the day of Pentecost. What in the world? How much wine have you been drinking? And they would argue, listen, guys, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. No, we're not drunk. When I accepted Christ in my junior year in high school and I realized what that was, I could enjoy life. And people made the wrong assumption. They assumed that I was drunk because I was at the hockey game enjoying life and celebrating. And said, nobody can enjoy things that much without being drunk. And their assumptions of me were wrong. They needed to talk with me. And we had to straighten that thing out. But many people just kept on going. And when they found that I was a principal in a high school, they go, really? You were the guy who was drunk at the hockey games. And I'd have to say, no, not really. But it's interesting. We can look at the world and we can come to our own conclusions. And sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. But God wants us to come to one conclusion, the truth about him. The truth is what we gather, all the pieces together that gives us an understanding, and then to know him. And we talked about that last week. God used the same word for Adam knew Eve, that intimate relationship. It wasn't an accident. He created the marriage so that we could understand the intimacies of a relationship, what it should be, and what he desires for us, to know him. And he's given us the wonderful and the beauty of a marriage so that we can grasp his love for us. We're going to talk about that, the lies that destroy lives, because Jesus does not want any false praises, and he doesn't want anybody to think of him in a different way. And many times the world, they don't understand him. Why? They crucified Jesus because they didn't know him. They didn't understand him. So let's look at I am who I am. You know, it's kind of funny. This is going to be a broad statement. This can get me in trouble. But people become older, they eventually hit that wonderful age, about 45, sometimes about 50, where they simply say, I really don't care what you think. I really don't. I am who I am. You take me or you leave me. I don't care. Okay? And some of you are chuckling. You realize that. Maybe you've said it. Maybe your wife has said it. Maybe a good friend of yours has said it. And they said, I really don't care. And God says, and he goes, I do care, but I want you to know I am who I am. And he's going to describe who he is. And the wonderful thing about God is that he not only describes who he is, he gives us examples so that we can determine, is he who he says he is? All right, so as we move, we're going to look at Exodus chapter 3. God has a wonderful sense of humor. And maybe not so funny when you're the one going through it. But when you can look at the life of other people and see God's handiwork, when he records it into scripture, you can kind of chuckle. Look at Moses, man. Oh, man, Moses, who I am. Moses had the opposite opinion. He thought himself great. He realized his salvation was brought in a very peculiar way as his mother blessed him, watched out over him, sent him on down the Nile. Instead of alligators grabbing him, Pharaoh's daughter took him in, and there he received the best education he could possibly have. And did he leave mom behind? No, mom came with and nursed him. And mom had the opportunity to tell Moses, you're not one of them. God's hand is on your life in a very special way. He has something for you. You're beautiful. Meaning that it wasn't his countenance. It wasn't his looks, but God had something beautiful that he was going to do through Moses. And that's the story. So Moses kind of grew up with this. And we know what happens to Moses as he realized that he was not an Egyptian, but he was a Hebrew. He saw the fighting between a Hebrew and an Egyptian, and he stepped in, and he killed him. He killed the Egyptian who was beating his Hebrew brother. And then he buried him in the sand. As the story goes in the previous chapter, we realize that as Moses, again, spending time, not in Pharaoh's court at this time, but out and about among his people, he saw two Hebrews fighting with one another, and he stepped in, and they said, "Who are you to judge us? Who made you ruler?" Have you ever heard that? Oh, I don't know how many times my children, my youngest child would say to my oldest child who would step in, you don't need to be doing that. You need to behave. And who made you mom? Or who made you dad? Who made you ruler over us? That's the exact same thing. Squabbling between two Hebrew brothers, and Moses stepped in. And he says, hey, stop. And he goes, who made you ruler over us? Will you kill us like you did the Egyptian? Whew. Moses realized two things. One, the people didn't receive him. Even though he knew his life was beautiful and it was called to deliver the people didn't see it. They didn't see it in his character. And he also knew, if they knew about it, everybody knew about it. And so this strong, courageous man who had confidence in God's calling upon his life feared. He feared and he ran. And he left. And Pharaoh was after him. So God takes him to the other side of the wilderness in a desert, and all of a sudden, instead of watching and taking care of all that could be under his authority, he's watching some sheep. And he gets married, and life goes on. He learns a lot of lessons, and all of a sudden, we are taken in chapter 3 here, where we have a burning bush. So the story can be rather interesting, but God has a specific point. And we're going to see the correlation between Moses and Jesus. And we're going to see, as we did earlier, between Genesis and the book of John, the new birth and the creation of the world. They're the same story. They're a beautiful story. But unless you look at them clearly, you're going to miss all the wonderful details that God has for you. And your misconceptions will be taken away. And what you will be left with is a clear vision of God who says, I am who I am. So in chapter 3 of Exodus, now Moses was tending the flock and Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness, and he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flames of fire from within the bush. And Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I'll go over there and see the strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from the bush, and he called him Moses. And he called him Moses. You know, my wife usually calls me honey, but when she calls me David, a lot of times it's not a good reason. But when she calls me David in that nice voice, it's music to my ears. And God Almighty calls him Moses. And he calls him Moses. Exclamation part. 2 times. And Moses said, here I am. This is the God who claims and will see, I am the great I am. And Moses says, here I am. And that's exactly the point. Moses, who are you? Just as Adam and Eve hid themselves from God behind a bush, and he called to them, now God shows himself in a bush and calls to Moses. And Moses says, I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off the sandals from the place where you are standing is holy ground. I tell you what, man, I'd be taking my sandals off. When God calls and says, David, David, and he gets your attention, and he got my attention, and he calls you by name, and he gets your attention, you realize this is not the time he's going to bestow upon you wonderful kisses and say, oh, I'm so happy with you. Now, in his fear and trembling, and God speaks to him, and he tells him to take off his sandals. What's wonderful to know, as you read the life of Moses, it was all about Moses, is what he thought of himself. God's not done with me. I have something I still need to do. Well, God's not done with you, Moses, because you're not done with yourself. And I'm going to work on that, is what God does. And that's what God does. And so we can look at the world and see a lot of things that are going on, but God is always, as we read further down in here, I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. You ever notice? He's the personal God. The Canaanites, the Egyptians, they had their God. God is a personal God. The God of Abraham. This is how you must know me, he goes further on to say in verses 15. This is how you must know me from generation to generation. This is my name forever. the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And now, Moses, I'm going to be your God. But Moses, we got to get rid of you. Meaning we're not going to destroy you, but we're going to change your heart and we're going to change your life, because when that happens, then I can use you to bring people to myself out of slavery. It took a time to do that. God's call was never changed. It was never in question. He knew exactly what he needed to do. And Moses along the way would find out God to be true. When God says, take off the sandals, you're not worthy, Moses. You're not worthy on the ground in which you are standing. We can never be worthy on ourselves to stand before God and before his calling. This is the same God, as you will look, read it later on, who personally buried his Moses. He didn't lift him up to the heavens. He didn't allow his bones to be left in Egypt or some other place. But God personally buried him. You know, when my mother died, it was a wonderful thing that I could take part of that and be a pallbearer. When my father died, I could do that. When I watched my grandfather die and I looked at my cousins all grab a side of that casket and they took care of their own, it is the most beautiful thing that I could find in the meaning of death. And here God personally buries this man, who at one time says, you're not even worthy to stand before me. Take off the sandals of your feet, the ground, my very presence. He does a work in his life. I am who I am. And God is interested in us knowing him for who he is. He doesn't back away from it. He's not ashamed of it. He welcomes us. But in order to know him, we have to be personal with him. And he is personal with us. Like Adam knew Eve, we must know God. We must study him. We must spend time with him. We can't expect to do that if all we do is on Sunday mornings gather together in his name and have spent time only then with him and not throughout the week. I am who I am, he says. Let's go to the New Testament, because you know what he says, before Abraham was, I am. And that's an interesting piece, because listen, I'm not the new kid on the scene here. I want you to know before Abraham. Well, who was before Abraham? The God of Genesis, in the beginning, God. That's who I am. That's the message that Moses was to go to the elders who would finally listen to him and realize that this is the same God of creation. This is the personal God who now is calling them. And this is the same God that we will see in the book of John. And let's go there now. Let's go to John chapter 8. Let's pick up with verse 48. Jesus claims about himself, just as God claimed, I am who I am, Jesus is claiming who he is. And it wasn't received so well. And Jesus answered him, aren't we right? And the Jews answered Jesus, aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and demon-possessed? Jesus' response is, I am not possessed by a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor him. I am not seeking glory for myself, but there is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. Truly, truly, I can't make this any clearer to you. Whoever obeys my words will never see death. At this they exclaim, now we know that you are demon-possessed. Abram died, and so did the prophets, yet you say that whoever obeys your word will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham? He did, and he died, and so did the prophets. Who do you think you are? The Jews wanted to take control of this conversation because they knew if they could make their statements, they knew if they could ask their questions, that the conclusion would come to exactly what they were proclaiming. We can prove, Jesus, that we say you are who we say you are. You are a Samaritan. You're not even a Jew. You're demon-possessed, and we're going to prove it. And they continue on with these conversations. Jesus replied, If I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Though you do not know him, I know him. I know him intimately. You do not. If I said I did not, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I obey his word. Your father, Abraham, rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. You are not 50 years old, they said to him, and you have seen Abraham? And so they're logically thinking. They're thinking, okay, let's look exactly what he's saying, but they're not interested in the truth in what he had to say. They want to look at things from a distance. And the world does that. They do that to us as believers in Christ. They do that all the time about God. They want to make conclusions from a distance. But in order to understand God, they have to draw closer. In order to understand God, God has got to draw them closer. And we'll see him do that. He did it in your life. He did it in mine. He does it in the world. It's hardship. It's heartache that draws people to him so that he might show himself. He says, very, very, I tell you, truly, truly, I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. And that statement, I am, outraged the Jews because they knew exactly what he was inferring. He was referring that he is, in fact, God, the God who spoke with Moses in the book of Exodus. He was claiming to be God, the very person that Abraham spoke with, and that was before Abraham. And they quickly wanted to rise up to destroy and to kill, because they could not see what he was saying. They judged from a distance. Because if they would actually look at everything that he did, they would know that this is the heart of God. They know that this would be only what God could do as he spout out demons. They knew that it would only be God who could calm the seas. They knew it could only be God who took bread and fish and fed 5,000 and then repeated it 7,000. The same God you see in Exodus who provides the manna. But Jesus just claiming I am was enough to make them angry. But he doesn't stop there. He doesn't stop there. And we'll later on talk about in the book of John, because this is such important. We'll see how he claims to be the I ams, the seven I ams of the book of John, that I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world. And he claims and proclaims and shows them this. But before we get there, let's go to point two. Who does the world say that I am? And if we look at the book of Mark, and I pull this as an example to you, as just one example of the many, many things that Jesus did. And it was so personal. It wasn't just that it was powerful. It was personal. It was intimate. Because this is the God whom we serve. This is the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. He is intimate. He is personal. I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Jacob. I am the God of David. I am your God. So we pick up in Mark, and let's look at verse 22. Jesus heals the blind man in Bethsaida. Just kind of tucked away there, easy to overlook. They came to Bethsaida, and some people, well, they brought a blind man. They brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. I love that. They begged Jesus. They petitioned him. God, Jesus, help this, our friend. And Jesus, he took the man. He took him by the hand. And he led him outside the village. They brought him and Jesus took him. And Jesus took him by the hand. You hold somebody's hand when you want to be intimate, when you're walking away. You see it when your child is crying, and you take them by the hand and you remove them from the rest of the family and you speak with them or you help them. Here is God Almighty, the great I Am, creator of heaven and earth, reaching out, taking him by the hand. And he takes him outside the village. And when he spit on the man's eyes, ooh, gross, spit on his eyes? It's not something that you would typically think, but it's something that would not be accepted all over the other place. Now, it's kind of interesting. In this culture that we live, it's okay if some sweaty athlete takes his jersey and he throws it to us in the stands and we grab it. Yeah, I got his DNA. I got his sweat all over this. He probably blew his nose on it. Oh, that's great. Okay, and we think, wow, I got a reward. But here Jesus, he spits in his eyes. Could you imagine the blind man not knowing what's going on, hearing the voice, hearing the spit, and then having it hit his face? And then he hits his eyes, and he says, and what happens here? And he put his hands on him. Jesus asks, do you see anything? It wasn't a spit as pushing away, you're detestable. It is a spit from the mighty hand, from the mighty mouth of God, warm. And he puts his hand on him. And he says to him, look up. And he looked up and he said, I see people. They look like trees walking around. Oh, guess he needs some more spit. Wasn't quite good enough, huh? Maybe Jesus was afraid this was going to be a little too tough, needed some privacy. We're going to try this. I'm going to spit in your face, okay. And we're going to see if your eyes will open. No. It's important to read the instant that happened here because of what follows. And we're going to get to that. Because sometimes we can see Jesus and we see him simply as a figure moving about. But he wants us to see clearly. And it takes time. It takes time. He looked up and he saw and he said, people, they look like trees walking around. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened and his sight was restored. It wasn't healed. It was restored. From the Garden of Eden, the vision of who God was stolen. And what God does in our life, through crisis, difficulties, through good times, blessings, he restores the image of who he is. Doesn't heal, he restores. Because it was God's intention from the very beginning that man would have fellowship with him. So Jesus coming and dying on the cross and Jesus working in our life has less to do with healing than it has to do with restoring. Because his intention has been, from Genesis to Revelation, to restore. Once more, Jesus put his hands on his eyes, and the eyes were open. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home, saying, don't even go into the village. It is here that we follow that Jesus and his disciples went on to the village around Caesarea and Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" And they replied, "Some say John the Baptist, and others say Elijah. Still others, one of the prophets." What do you think that man would say? He would say, "He's compassionate. He's loving. He's intimate. He is God, and he is powerful." All they could see was the power, and they missed the heart. If all we can see is the power of God and not his intention, we don't know him like Adam knew Eve. Like Adam knew what his wife's desires, her hurts, her concerns, her loves were. And so we go on, and here is the story. Here is the story of the great I am. Who do they say that I am? Who do you, then comes, as he asked Peter, do you say, I am? Who do you say, Peter, is God? Because that's what Jesus was saying. How well do you know me, Peter? Well, you are the Messiah. Yep. But what else does that mean? When are you going to restore your kingdom, God? No, I will restore it as the Father sees the best time. You're not seeing me clearly. Who do you say that I am? Let's go down to, there's one thing I have in here. I want to look at this. In your bulletin, you're going to find, I put this in yesterday because it was I've been thinking about it and I pulled this up and I, take this out of your bulletin. You're gonna notice all these verses here. And what I want to do, I'm just going to start this with you, but I want you to take it home because it is who God says he is. You'll notice on the very front it says, nothing speaks more clearly of God's love than the cross. And that's true. That's ultimately what he did. But you know, why did he do it? Did he simply have to prove that he had the power over death? I am the resurrection. I got the power. Go ahead and destroy me. And in 3 days, I will raise this temple. This packet here is from Genesis to Revelation. It is the Alpha and the Omega. It is God's story from the very beginning, before he ever spoke the worlds into existence, to when he will eventually return and the culmination of everything. And that's when the full truth will all be known. But this is God's message, has been a father's love. Because as Jesus came, that's one of the things his message was so peculiar. I am the Son, and the Father loves me. And if you follow me, if you accept me, God restores you, and you become my brother, and he becomes your father. And so, who is this guy? Who is this God, the great I am? Well, here's the heart of God. This is why he went to the cross. It wasn't to show that he was the Messiah only, but there was a lot of heavy work that he had to carry and a lot of heavy things he had to do, and he had the power and the authority to do it, but he did it with the heart. Moses wasn't received by the people because they couldn't see a Messiah's heart. It wasn't until he started working in the heart of Moses that the people would start to listen to him. People will not listen to us about the gospel until they see the love of the gospel within us, and then they'll want to know. So as we look at this, read the following verses prefaced with, "My God." For example, "My God, you may not know me." "My child," not "my God," I'm sorry. "My child, you may not know me, but I know everything about you. My child, I know when you sit down and when you rise up." What I'm going to ask you to do as a congregation, I'm going to ask you to say, "My child." and then I'm going to read the text. Understand? So together, you will say, Mitch, I'll do the first one with you, and then I'll continue to read the text. When I'm finished reading the text, you read the my child, and then I will continue on. All right. My child, you may not know me, but I know everything about you. I know when you sit down and when you rise up. I am familiar with all of your ways. Even the very hairs of your head are numbered. For you were made in my image. In me you live and move and have your being. For you are my offspring. I knew you even before you were conceived. I chose you when I planned creation. You are not a mistake. For all your days are written in my book. Thank you. Continue with this. Look at this. This is the heart of God and why he went to the cross. He is the Messiah. He will bring his kingdom and he will bring an end to all of this, just as he was the God who created it. But to know God, to know him intimately, you must know his heart. These words, these verses, from Genesis to Revelation, talk about a father's heart, a father's love. No greater love is this, that a man should lay down his life for his friends. And to think that God calls us a friend, the heart of God. But Jesus doesn't stop there, because when he declared that who he was, and the Jewish people had a hard time, the Jewish leaders had a very hard time, the common man did not, because it was the common man who received the healing, who received the touch of Jesus, who received the hand of Jesus. It was the common man and the common woman who stopped in the middle when crowds were around, and he would say, "Who's touched me?" And everybody would look at him, "Are you crazy? All these people has touched me." No, somebody's touched me in a different way. And the woman would realize that she had been healed. And God realized, and she realized that the Messiah was calling her out, so that he can know her and that she would know him. That is our God. But Jesus says in the third point here, "I am the bread of life." And you may look and say, what is the substance of everything we do? If we do not eat, we cannot live. And God says, absolutely, and I love you, and I provide for you. And the man over there and the nation over there that curses me, I made sure that they had grain and they had food. And the birds, I made sure that they had food. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world, and every morning that light comes up, and every evening it settles, and it's constant, it's consistent. And if you look at the solar system and the universe, you know that mathematically it is balanced, it is precise. I am the light of the world, and I am the door of the sheep, meaning that nobody is going to come in, no wolf is going to come and steal you at night in the darkest, when it's the gloomiest, when it's the most threatened. I stand at the door. I am the door. And he says, I am the resurrection and the life. Lazarus, I raise you. Your sisters mourn. We have hope. We will see our loved ones. Because he says, I am the resurrection and the life. And I am the way of how you ought to live. I am the way that God has planned for me and for the world. And I am the truth. And I am life. And the last, I am the Alpha and I am the Omega. I am. I am. The last piece, the last point is, who then am I? Am I, as point A say, the world would say, I am a product of chance. I am pond scum. I'm simply biology, DNA. I just live out this existence. I am derived from apes. what others think. That's who I am. I am without purpose. I am design. I am ugly. No. That's who the world will say you are. That's, in fact, the next point. Who does God say you are? He says you are the apple of his eye. If we would look at the true interpretation, that would, he says, look at the pupil. That is like an apple. You are the apple of my eye. You are the little man in my image. You are the reflection. I am that close to you. That is who you are. You're not pond scum. You're not by chance. I designed you from creation. That's why I went to the cross, to restore, to reclaim. The application, as we're going to conclude here, time is running out. Can I say I am recreated in God's image? Or where are we in that journey, as Moses was? Does he have a purpose for your life? Absolutely. He created you with design and purpose. And he may take you through some hard times that you'll stand before him and realize that, as our brother mentioned, we must decrease and he must increase. Because when we do, we find life, we find happiness, and we have joy, even in the midst of sorrows. Number two, and this is the big one, I think. Have I recreated God in my own image? We can look at wars and pestilence. We can look at all the ugliness that humanity brings upon this world. And many times the allegations that are brought by the world about God is actually allegations about themselves and the God that they have created. Because God has given us the freedom to be able to create this world. Wars and rumors of wars, what man does to man. It is the God that man has created. It is the God that they are themselves. What lies have I believed about God, myself, in my life? Read this. Read all the verses that God describes how he sees you. Is that how you see yourself? Then you need your vision changed. You need the spit of Jesus upon your eyes. You need to be taken out of the hustle and the bustles of life and spend time with him and let his put his hands on you and heal you. Restore your vision. It doesn't take just one time. It takes a lifetime. And that's what we're called to.